Hi, this is Paul. This is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. Now, Friday is Veterans Day, and I'm going to take it off. So this is being done a day early, which I don't know what that'll mean. It'll mean that the sermon has an extra day to sort of marinate before I bring it out on Sunday morning. How to live as the people of the Creator God in a skeptical land. This morning, someone sent me this article by Tim Keller, watching a pastor in Australia who is responding to the chief or the head of his council, the lay head of his council, who stepped down from a prominent Australian football job because it was discovered that he belonged to a church that had a traditional view of human sexuality and marriage, and was also against abortion. And the pastor was called upon to answer for this, and apparently this video has made the rounds. The pastor didn't do particularly well. It was definitely not a situation of, let's say, Jordan Peterson and Kathy Newman. And I'll put the link below, and so you can read the article and follow it. But this is just another illustration of the challenge that the Apostle Paul is facing in the first century in dealing with the Corinthians. In the 20th century, there was a lot of alignment between the Christian sexual ethic and the West's sexual ethic. And since the sexual revolution, the separation between churches that have tended to hold that traditional ethic and the sexual ethic of the rest of the West, that division has continued to widen. And pastors and a lot of individuals are having difficulty figuring out, well, what do we do with this? How do we talk about this? Do we hardline it? Do we accommodate to the changes? Do we turtle up or bunker up? Those tend to be the main approaches that people take to such questions. Now, again, Paul, dealing with the Corinthians, is basically dealing with similar type issues. We've been looking at this section now in 1 Corinthians from chapter 8 through chapter 10, where Paul has to answer this question. How should Christians live in the Greco-pagan Roman Empire? Are they to accommodate to that world? And if so, to what extent? Are they to blend in or stand apart? And the question of food offered to idols offers Paul a concrete case study in discussing this critical issue. Now, if you look at Kenneth Bailey's outline here, you'll notice that Paul touches on it in chapter 8, and then he'll pick it up again in chapter 10. But everything in between has to do with the process of figuring out what to do. Now, the Corinthian leaders see themselves as the mature, and they feel very at home in Corinth. For one reason or another, they have picked up Jesus and seen him to be useful to them and helpful to them in order to pursue the kinds of things that they wanted. The leaders of the church seemed to be wealthy, well-educated, and had ideas how this new religion of Jesus could bring them what they wanted. For example, in chapter 5, we saw that they were boasting about a man who was sleeping with his stepmother. Now, to many of us, that sounds strange, and it was even ran afoul of the Roman Empire's sexual ethic, but there was likely some advancement in wealth or status that the young man would have, and they saw the new freedom in Christ as perhaps offering a way to justify a move like this. The Corinthian church had a sexual ethic that seemed even more libertine, let's say, than conservative Roman sexual ethics. Now, if I say conservative Roman sexual ethics, you might imagine that the Roman sexual ethic was conservative according to our standards, but that certainly wouldn't be the case. But the Romans very much saw their sexual ethic as orderly and traditional. And the Corinthian church is trying to figure out, well, how does all of this fit together? This new liberation in Jesus. And then you have Paul coming down basically with the Jewish sexual ethic from the book of Deuteronomy. Paul sees the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus as rewriting Israel's God's mission to the world. Jesus was the Creator God's mission to enfold the nations. And the Corinthians want him either to agree with them or to be an authoritarian scourge that they can dismiss or ignore depending on whether it suits their agenda. And so he continues, this is the last part of chapter 8, as we read last week, dealing with food sacrificed to idols. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your rights does not become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone with a weak conscience sees you, with all your knowledge, eating in an idol's temple, won't that person be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols? So this weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. That person might in fact sort of be sucked back into their old way of life. When you sin against them in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Paul was telling them, okay, well, maybe there's nothing behind these idols in the temple, and maybe you know this by your esoteric knowledge or your monotheistic knowledge, yet you might not be sinning against God in this manner, in the way that others imagine, but you are sinning against the rest of the church. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause them to fall. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus as our Lord? Are you not the result of my work in the Lord? Now, even as I hear some people mention it today in some of my online conversations, there's questions about Paul's apostleship that the Corinthians are raising. Peter seems to be a bona fide apostle who was part of the 12 and saw Jesus, the risen Lord, and saw him ascend. Peter saw all of that. Paul saw Jesus in the sky. Does that qualify him for an apostle? Paul makes the point, I'm your apostle because I, in fact, was sent to you to found the church which you all are now leading. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. In other words, he's making the claim that you yourselves are evidence of my apostleship, because if you doubt my apostleship, you're going to have to doubt whether or not you're grafted into Christ. This is my defense to those who sit in judgment on me. Don't we have the right to food and drink? Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brother and Cephas? So James, the brother of Jesus, and Peter, like most good Jewish men, were married, and when they traveled, then they would take their wives with them. And Paul says, don't I have this right? In other words, Paul is saying, or is it that only I and Barnabas who lack the right to not work for a living? Now, Paul wades into something here because the Corinthians very much have their ideas about status and hierarchy. And Paul is basically saying, if I use your measures of status, I am above you. I founded your church. The only reason you have any status in the church is because of me. So if we use your standards, well, by that logic, you should listen to me. Now, Paul is also wrestling with the question of money and compensation and people who do this religious job. And once again, not only with sex, not only with food sacrificed to idols, but now also with respect to money, he's sort of caught between the Jewish world and the Greco-Roman pagan world. Here's an explanation from Kenneth Bailey about how the Jews handled the question of religious leadership and money. As observers, there was no friction between Paul and the Corinthians because he worked with his hands. For most Jewish believers, this would not have been a problem. Granted, Ben Shirach looked down on all tradesmen and traders, but the rabbis did not. The rabbis supported themselves financially, often through some trade or skill. Indeed, they were required to do so. No one was allowed to dig with the crown. The Torah was thought of as a golden crown, and no one was permitted to use it as a spade, that is, to use it to make money. The teachers of Torah could not receive any material benefit from his students except food and housing. Hillel, who lived one generation before Jesus, is quoted as having said, "He that makes worldly use of the crown shall perish." Paul fit into that rabbinic mold. On the other hand, for Christians with Greek backgrounds, things were different. Intellectuals were expected to be financially independent. Only with the leisure that comes with such independence was it possible to cultivate the mind. How could Greeks accept intellectual and spiritual leadership from a tent maker? This is not totally foreign to many modern cultures east and west. Is the local priest or pastor respected when he insists on supporting himself as a garage mechanic? The congregation tries to pay him, and he replies, "I prefer to fix cars." This from another commentary from, there it's good to put the citations in, from Richard Hayes. It's important to remember that Paul did not fit readily into any recognizable job description within the culture of the Corinthians. There was no established model for Christian ministers, nor were there existing institutions such as universities or church denominations to employ or sanction teachers or preachers. Paul was simply a freelance missionary. The Corinthians would naturally have coin-paired him with the rhetoricians and philosophers familiar with their world. Ronald F. Hawk has explained that within this cultural setting, there's an ongoing debate about the appropriate means of economic support for a philosopher. Four basic models were advocated, each with its own distinctive drawback. The philosopher could charge for his teaching, as the sophists did, but they were often accused of greed and manipulating their pupils. Alternatively, the philosopher could be educated, could be supported by a wealthy patron, as the resident intellectual in the patron's household, often with the task of educating the family's children. Such a role entailed him with the obvious loss of independence, for the philosopher would be tied to the purse strings of the patron. Now, this was probably the reason that Paul continued to be a tent maker and didn't want to take money from the Corinthian church, because he would have been indebted to them in a certain way, and it would have been more difficult for him to speak about what was going on. A third option, notoriously practiced by the cynics, was to beg on the streets. For obvious reasons, this was widely perceived as eccentric and demeaning. The final option was for philosophers to work at a trade in order to support himself. This had the disadvantage of low social status and of consuming time and energy for mundane matters. At least, however, working for a living preserved the philosopher's independence from control by other people. And so that's the way that Paul would have been perceived. But again, he's got a social status problem with this, and that social status problem is seen in the attitudes of the Corinthians towards Paul. Paul continues in verse 9. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat its grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink the milk? Did I say this merely on human authority? Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it is written in the law of Moses, "Do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain." Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he said this for us, doesn't he? Yes, this was written for us. Now again, notice how, once again, for the Corinthians, for whom the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, is not a book that they necessarily turn to first, they're living within their cultural framework, he once again redirects them back to the law of Moses. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? But we do not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Okay, so we've been looking at Corinthian sexuality, we've been looking at food sacrifice to idols, and now we're looking at the question of monetary compensation for the service that Paul is rendering to the Corinthian church. And with each of these, Paul turns to and says, but what we do is we look at the cross of Christ. This is our priority. The logos of the cross of Christ, how that logos was changed from the Roman logos of the cross, is central to the entire book, and it's central to the application of all these different examples of Paul trying to figure out how to reconcile, not reconcile really isn't the right way, but how to live between the Jewish tradition of the Old Testament and the Greco-Roman culture that Paul is dealing with. Don't you know that those who serve in the temple get their food from the temple? And this would have been true both in Jerusalem and in Corinth, with the Jewish temple and with the pagan temples. And that those who serve at the altar share in what is offered on the altar? In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. But I have not used any of these rites. And I am not writing this in the hope that you will do such a thing for me. For I would rather die than allow anyone to deprive me of this boast. For when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, since I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I am simply discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge, and so not make full use of my rights as a preacher of the gospel. So he's basically telling the Corinthians here, I am doing this for your sake. I understand how you are, and this is in fact for you. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone, to win as many as possible. To the Jews I became like a Jew, to win the Jews. To those under the law I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak I became weak, to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I might share in its blessing. Now, this is actually a very difficult passage, even though it's quoted very often, because it's most often misunderstood by Paul saying, basically, he becomes these other things. That's not actually what he's saying here. He's saying is that he behaves in certain ways in order to achieve his goal. Now, he says to the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. He does not say to the Greeks, I became like a Greek to win the Greeks, because he will never be a Greek. He will always be a Jew, and he's walking that line carefully. Paul does not become a Gentile, and he never says this. What he's really playing on is this whole drama of the weak and the mature. And so if you break down this passage, like I should probably put Kenneth Bailey's footnote in there again. If you break down the argument basically to its components, it's a nice little structure. I became a slave to all people. I became a Jew. For Jews, I lived under the Torah. For Gentiles, I lived outside of the Torah. But again, he's saying very carefully, I lived outside of the Torah, but I continued to live under the law of Christ. And then, if you look at the structure here again, I became a Jew. What's parallel? The first point and the last point are parallel. I became a slave to all people. I became all things to all people. In other words, this is the manner by which he serves. He becomes a slave to all people, and he becomes all things to all people. I became a Jew. I became weak. Well, what does he mean by weak? Well, what he means by weak is that he's becoming like those with weaker consciences. He takes the underposition for the sake of the Corinthian church, who consider themselves the mature. Leaders want to appear strong, and this is what the Corinthian leaders want Paul to This is how the Corinthian leaders want Paul to appear. They are often willing to serve the weak, but as long as they are seen by the public as strong, you see this all the time in politics. From a position of strength, they will reach out to those in need. In contrast, Paul deliberately becomes weak to win the weak. His mission from below informs everything he does. As a Roman citizen, he could have claimed status and privilege. A profound theology of mission is affirmed in these simple words. The incarnation itself was an act of becoming as one weak. Paul explores the incarnation with his famous words about Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave. In John's gospel, at a well in Samaria, Jesus emptied himself to the extent that he needed the help of a simple, immoral, foreign woman, John 4. As he sent his disciples out two by two, he carefully instructed them to travel with almost nothing. They were to take no staff, nor bag, nor bread, nor money. In short, they were to go in weakness and poverty, and to travel in the need of those they sought to serve. Following his Lord, Paul went to the world in great weakness. which he described dramatically in 2 Corinthians 11:23 to 29. That catalog of powerlessness ends with, "Who is weak? Am I not weak? Who is made to fall? Am I not on fire with indignation?" So this, in fact, is what Paul has been teaching them all the time. And it's a complete rewriting of how they imagine the world works. "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified." You see right here, he sees the danger in preaching, that he himself might take on the Corinthian culture and be as one of them, imagine himself the mature, and have in that him disqualified. Now, he will walk that line a lot in this letter. "Follow me as I follow Christ. I am, you are the ones, you owe me this because, of course, I have been the source by which you received Christ." And all of that is legitimate, but you see how he plays this both ways, upside and downside, basically following Christ. Now, this sports metaphor the Corinthians would have gotten because they had their own version of sort of Olympic games that happened near Corinth and that the city of Corinth was very proud of. While the mature consider their privileges and their freedoms, Paul is pursuing an entirely different goal. He's not asking, "What can Jesus do for me?" but "What can I do for my Lord?" Now, whether it's sex, religious pluralism, meat sacrifice to idols, leadership practices, money and power, this gospel refinement that Paul is laying down has basically been churning in the church, refining the church throughout the history of the church. The template that Paul lays here, even if we're not dealing with similar matters, is something for us to consider as we wrestle with the kinds of issues we deal with today. We're getting not only the content of what Paul is dealing with Corinth, but the message will always be with us. This question of the cross, this question of the weak, this question of the practice which comes from Christ himself. Philippians 2, "Although he did not consider equality with God something to be exploited, made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant. Although," Paul says, "I am the source of your claim to the gospel, I myself will be weak so that I might win some of the weak." The logos of the cross of Christ continues to move through history, and Paul is laying it out here. It continues to rework the way of the world. Paul becomes the weak in order to shame the strong. Paul becomes the weak in order that the Gentiles might participate in the reclamation of a world in rebellion. Paul will lay out all of the, Paul will lay all other things aside for this mission, and he invites the Corinthian leaders and us too into that mission.